Your Majesty, Your Royal Highness, distinguished guests and honored speakers. In the absence of the chairman of the Palace Committee, Major Eberhard van der Laan, it is my pleasure to welcome you. A warm welcome at this special location, the former City Hall of Amsterdam and nowadays a royal palace. Thanks to our hosts, His and Her Majesty and Her Royal Highness, it is a very special royal palace. It is often open for the public. It is a place for debate and culture, exhibitions and symposia like this. We are always very grateful for that. As an inhabitant of both an urban and a rural area, I am of course personally privileged to have best of both. But it is also a strange way of living, I can assure you. You are living with one leg on a kind of one ice floe and with the other leg on another ice floe. Often I think that I'm witnessing day after day one of the deepest cultural gaps, a hidden gap, but a very deep gap in the world, the gap between the city and the countryside. We are really talking about two worlds, and in the same time, both worlds are totally connected. 2 years ago, we organized a palace symposium on the future of big cities. Today, we discuss the opposite, rural areas. I hope, of course, that it will help me redefine my personal identity, but much more important, also our collective identity as a country and also as a part of Europe. Let me introduce you our chair of this evening, who will in turn introduce our keynote speaker and lead the discussion this afternoon and evening. Tracy Metz, journalist, original on architecture, but broadened her interest and horizon in many ways. Initiator of the so-called Stadsgesprekken, city talks, at which the relation between urban and rural has been a topic more than once. American of birth, but now a true Amsterdammer. She speaks both languages fluently, also Amsterdam's and also perhaps a little bit Frisian, you never know. So she can, if necessary, translate. Tracy, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Geert. Welcome. Thank you for joining us on behalf of the Palace Commission and, of course, the Royal House. I'm very honored to be your moderator today. It is telling that this week we are experiencing two events simultaneously, this gathering today to talk about rural decline and what we can do about it, and at the same time, on the same days this week, the first edition of the International Social Housing Festival, addressing the lack of housing, which is caused by the overwhelming success of cities now. As you said, Geert, this is one of the deepest cultural gaps of our time, and at the same time, they are so closely intertwined. The Palace Commission has invited all of you and our guest of honor, Mark Chucksmith, to talk about rural decline, but more even to talk about how to turn it around and a possible upside. I myself recently saw one of the upsides as a member of the jury of the Dutch Street Art Award, one of the awards for one of the categories of the awards was given to the city of Heerlen. I believe the mayor of Heerlen is here today. Yes, hello, welcome. We saw each other at the awards. And the fact that Heerlen has suffered such decline has created fantastic opportunities for street artists to create a whole new image of Heerlen, which is bringing people together and uniting them around a new urban expression. I think that's one of the really interesting flip sides of decline that we'll be looking into today. Professor Chucksmith has deep knowledge and a lot of great stories. And I hope, I think we all hope, that after this gathering today, that you will go home feeling uplifted and optimistic about not so much rural decline, but about the buzzword of today, the rural renaissance. Before I give the floor to Professor Chucksmith, two practical announcements. We are operating today under Chatham House rule. That means that you are free to tell the world that you're here and what it's all about, but please do not quote anyone directly. And also, no pictures, please. We will have a plenary session with Professor Chucksmith at the end of the day, so feel free with your notebook to gather your thoughts and your questions for him, and we're really looking forward to your input in the discussion later today. I would like to now introduce our keynote speaker, Professor Mark Chucksmith, Director of the Newcastle University Institute for Social Renewal and a Professor of Planning at Newcastle University. The floor is yours.
Your Majesty, Your Royal Highness, ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted and honored to be here today, and also with some trepidation after that build-up. I hope that I can at least start some good discussions about the possibilities for turning rural decline into rural renaissance. And I'm maybe going in the wrong direction, let's see. It's on the screen down here, so there's a hope that's hopeful. I'm going to talk about rural decline. I've heard in our conversations over the last hour or so about some of the experiences that you're facing in your own communities, and recent trends in some rural areas of the Netherlands are worrying. Especially in the peripheral areas. And I've been looking through, I can't say I've read the whole thing, but I've been reading some of Geert Maak's rich chronicle, Jo Vert, which I think I need to learn how to pronounce better, whether it's in Dutch or in Frisian. But it's a wonderful book, beautifully written, revealing not only rural decline, but also the social changes, the very personal changes which have affected people in this part of the Netherlands. And he places these in a broad historical and international context of traditional villages beset by globalization and a sense of loss. And reading it, there were phrases, there were words, there were stories which reminded me of interviews I'd done in parts of the Western Isles of Scotland, the remotest parts of Northern Scotland, where people spoke to me about how it seemed the rural communities and everything they valued was slipping through their fingers like sand. There was a real sense of loss, a sense that change was inevitable, and they were mourning that and didn't know what to do. They felt as if they had no control, no power over what was happening to them. So I understand what he's talking about, albeit in a very different context from the context of the Netherlands. But what I want to talk about today is not the story of that loss and the sense of loss, but about the future of such places. Is rural decline inevitable, or could Renaissance be possible? And if Renaissance is possible, what could that mean? And whose responsibility might it be to turn things around? Who are the people who could do something about it? And I want to start by setting this in the context of rural Europe today. And this diagram has been presented and used a few times to summarize a general picture of what seems to be happening in rural Europe in a simplified schematic way. And it's interesting that the areas which seem to be prospering most when you look across Europe are not so much the cities, but the accessible rural areas, those within commuting distance of the cities. They're growing because there's counter-urbanization sometimes and in some places, but more generally there is the possibility of commuting from these accessible rural areas to well-paid jobs in the diversified and modern economies of the cities. And families are moving to these places, there's structural diversity, and many other favourable factors. And these are contrasted not just with the cities, but with the remoter rural areas, which are seen as prone to decline, to emptying out, as we've heard, through rural urban migration, either to the cities or more often to these accessible areas or to the small towns. The population is aging, the economies are maybe still too dependent on agriculture, and so on and so forth. I think this is what you're familiar with, and there is that tendency across Europe. But it's not a rule, because if you go to remote rural areas across Europe, you will find some which are not declining. They're not declining in population, they're not declining in terms of their jobs, their prospects, and most importantly, they see a future. The people in those areas see a future for themselves which is exciting and which attracts people to come there. So what is it about these places? What are the assets which they have which has turned around the rural decline into a rural renaissance? But before we get to look in detail at that, well, let me just examine a few more features across rural Europe. You might think that rural areas are typically poorer than urban areas, but that's not the case across the whole of Europe. So this diagram, I don't ask you to read all the details of it, but it compares places according to the OECD's classification of predominantly urban, intermediate, and predominantly rural areas. And what it's showing is that in the four countries on the left, poverty is more associated with urban areas than with rural ones. And that I think, includes the Netherlands. Then there is a group of countries in the middle where poverty is more associated with rural areas than urban. And those are mainly in Eastern Europe and Southern Europe. And then there's a group of countries on the right where there isn't really much difference between urban and rural areas in terms of the incidence of poverty. This is using the standard measure of poverty in terms of 60% of the median income. And we don't only have to look at poverty measures. About 10 years ago, I analysed the European Quality of Life Survey to see what urban-rural differences there were, not only in monetary measures like poverty, but also in terms of deprivation and wider measures of how people felt about their quality of life. And again, you don't have to look in detail at all of these pictures. The story is that when you band countries according to GDP per head, the richest countries in the top level, that's the 12 countries in Europe with the highest GDP per head, there was no real difference between urban and rural areas in poverty, in deprivation, in house, and subjective economic strain. When you go to areas which were more intermediate, then a gap began to open up. Rural areas began to be poorer than the urban areas. And the lower you go in terms of GDP per head for the country, the more the gap between urban and rural areas opens up, so that by the time you get to the countries which were at that time applying to join the European Union, the candidate countries, the three candidate countries, you see right at the bottom that the urban income was three times the rural income on average. And you know, these differences just became more and more apparent. So the urban-rural disparities are to some extent a story of poorer countries rather than richer countries. In the richer countries, there's no real difference between rural and urban areas in terms of their quality of life and their income. So why might this be? One of the factors that has been uncovered in a number of research projects is the importance of the industrial structure of the rural economies. Again, here's something you don't need to look at the details of, but it's a typology of different rural areas across Europe. And we, in this study, related statistically the economic performance and the demographic performance of these regions with their industrial structure. And broadly what we found was that the more reliant on agriculture a rural economy was, the poorer it was, and the more likely it was to be losing population and losing jobs and income. And diversified rural regions were much more dynamic in their economies, in their demography, and in other respects as well. And just to summarize that, there are some summary statistics from our project here, which takes the predominantly urban areas at the top. That's what PU stands for. And then those regions which are mainly characterized as agrarian, and down towards the bottom, the more diversified. And you can see that in terms of the land area, agrarian regions cover about 24% of the total area of the EU27, but have only 12% of the population and generate only 6% of the gross domestic product. So agrarian regions are less populated and produce much less of the production. By contrast, other rural regions which had diversified economies, particularly those that had diversified into services, pulled their weight. They covered 28% of the area, had 24% of the population, and generated 22% of the GDP. So decline is characteristic of regions which remain primarily agricultural, while rural regions which have diversified into manufacturing or services especially are more prosperous and dynamic. But that just tells you about summary figures across Europe. It gives some European context to the experiences that you're facing in your own communities in the Netherlands. And it doesn't mean that there isn't a change going on. So there may still be that sense of loss, but maybe also some possibilities for the future there. So my message so far is that even remote rural areas can thrive. But how? I've given some hints already in terms of the industrial structure, but what are the ingredients of rural renaissance, if such a thing is possible? And to explore this in a little more detail, I'm going to take you on a journey. I thought that would be far more interesting than lots of statistics and maps, and I hope I'm correct there. And I have a few examples, not just these pictures, though I should tell you what these are. Obviously, there's a diversified farmer at the top there. The second picture is of amazing diversification project. This is in Sweden, a former quarry which has been turned into an opera venue called Dalhalla. Dalhalla. And then at the bottom, a remote Scottish island with three wind turbines, which are called by the local people Faith, Hope and Charity. a visual and symbolic indicator of the hope and faith and charity for the future. But let me take you to my three case studies. So first of all, to Norway. And I'm going to take you to the former copper mining town of Røros in mid-Norway. These copper mines closed in 1977 after 333 years. It's a one-horse town. Its raison d'etre is the mining. There was no other reason for it to be there. It's far from other places. And in 1977, when the mines closed, most people in Røros could only look forward to living in a ghost town or moving away. But instead, this has become a success story. You'd never believe it. How has that happened? The mayor was pivotal in bringing together the labor movement, the trades unions, the employees, the employers, the management of the mine, and the local authority to forge a new social contract and a new vision. And the new vision was really important. The idea was that people might be interested to come and look at these old mines, the historic wooden buildings that are there, and to look at the cultural heritage of this place that to most people at that time just seemed a site of devastation, all the spoil heaps of the mines and so on. So tourism and the sale of arts and crafts became the most important industries based on the preservation of the 300-year-old wooden buildings in Røros town and the conversion of several of the mines into museums. People flock to this area now, as you can see in the lower picture, which looks more like a Christmas card. The special cultural atmosphere of the town attracts artists as well as tourists, adding to the experience. So Røros today is a UNESCO World Heritage Centre with growing prosperity, built on that leadership and vision and cooperation between public and private interests in the town and the region, and the valorisation of its cultural heritage. And there are a few more pictures to show you how it looks today, something which was unimaginable in 1977, except that a few people imagined it. They had this vision and made it a reality with cooperation and the support of the state. Let me take you now to somewhere which is very different from a former mining town. It's an island, the Isle of Skye in Scotland. Many of you will have heard of the Isle of Skye and all the romantic stories around its past. The Isle of Skye off the west coast of Scotland is more than 2 hours from the nearest city, Inverness, which in turn is a long way from everywhere else. I learned how far away it is when the government asked me to chair a commission on the future of crofting in these areas, and it took me almost a whole day just to travel to the area each time I went there, never mind then travelling around the village halls and community meeting places. Skye had lost two-thirds of its population between 1841 and 1971. The population had fallen from 23,000 to 7,000. But since then, its population has grown by a third. After losing two-thirds, it's grown by a third to 10,000 and rising today. What happened? How was long-term rural decline transformed into rural renaissance? The roots of the transformation seem to me and to others who've examined it to lie in the local population's newfound confidence and self-belief. Where did it come from? In the 1960s, a network of local history societies was formed, which revealed the rich cultural heritage of the Gaelic people and their language, far from Gaelic being, as they'd been told, a symbol of primitive peasant status. They found this rich literature and poetry and music and art. And this was not something, as they'd been told, to be discarded during modernization. It became a marker of distinction, generating pride and confidence. Gaelic teaching was introduced into schools and preschools. A new Gaelic college, Solmore Ostaig, which I'll show you a picture of on the left here, was established with money from a philanthropist to teach next generation that Gaelic could be used in the workplace as well as in the home. So people were taught workplace skills using the Gaelic language. Related to this renewed self-confidence was the growth of a strong social movement promoting community action and land reform, harking back to times before the enclosures and the privatization of land into feudal estates owned too often by absentee landlords. We'll see the fruits of this in a moment, in another example. Meanwhile, and this is very important, there was also support from the state, who established an economic development agency, the Highlands and Islands Development Board, in 1965, to promote economic and social development in the north of Scotland. This supported infrastructure, new businesses, and community empowerment, and indeed, the community land movement, and has been hugely successful. Latterly, its support for places like Skye has involved a community land unit and a land fund using lottery money, which enable local communities to purchase the landed estates on which they live. So that's an amazing transformation, again based on community leadership, activism, but this self-confidence growing out of a new knowledge of people's cultural heritage and their history, but with important support from an enabling state. Let me go now to a final example, which is also in Scotland, and which builds a little bit on what I've just been saying, and this is the Isle of Egg. The Isle of Egg is tiny. It's 9 kilometres by 5 kilometres. It's accessible only by ferry, weather permitting, off the west coast of Scotland. A series of absentee landlords, often very eccentric absentee landlords, owned the island, neglecting its houses, its infrastructure, and its people, and even evicting tenants to the point where its population had fallen to only 62 people. On the 12th of June 1997, 20 years ago from this weekend just past, the people of Egg bought the island as a community land trust for £1.5 million in the very first community buyout. And this photo at the bottom here shows them celebrating what they called Independence Day. and they've had more celebrations this weekend, as you can imagine. An anonymous donor heard about intention when it was presented in the media and on television. An anonymous donor from the north of England gave £1 million, and their identity's never been revealed. The rest was raised through what we now would call crowdfunding, but which didn't exist then, through small donations and a small grant from the Highlands Islands Development Board, which I've already mentioned. This community land trust has developed community-owned businesses, including a shop, tourist facilities, workspaces, hydroelectric power and wind farms. They're now 98% renewables generating their energy. They have a strange system by which none of them will use too much electricity and blow the whole system, and that works well. They have new affordable houses because in rural areas in Britain we need affordable social housing in rural areas as well as urban areas. Broadband, a doctor's surgery, a new pier and ferry, and a community hall. And these have become the basis for a thriving community of now over 100 people and growing, and young people are moving there because they can see a future that they want to be part of. They feel an excitement about this. And on Egg's Independence Day 20 years ago, a minister from the Scottish Government who had 20 years earlier been an activist in Skye himself, he surprised his civil servants by announcing the creation of this community land unit to support and advise other communities interested in similar buyouts. And he announced this land fund, funded by the National Lottery, to offer loans to such ventures. Within 6 years, new legislation funded from the National Lottery, within 6 years, new legislation followed in the Land Reform Scotland Act, which gives communities a preemptive right to buy when estates come on the market. And with this support, many communities have followed a similar path. The map on the right shows the communities which have bought their land. More than half of the Hebrides are now in community land ownership. Those are the islands off the west coast. More than half that land is now in community ownership. In all, 500,000 acres, 200,000 hectares are in community control, and the Scottish Government has a target for doubling that by 2020 to 1 million acres. So some inspiring stories. The picture on the left is a book which tells the story of all these community buyouts and how they happened, if you're wanting further details of these inspiring stories. But you've heard some inspiring stories, I hope. What are the lessons which we can draw from those? What might be the ingredients, if you will, for rural renaissance? Some of the things you've heard are specific to each place. Every place has its own context. You can't just transfer something from one place to another. But there are things which are generalizable, and I'll try just briefly to draw those out towards the end of my talk now. And I'll go into each of these in detail, but the ingredients as I see it are, first of all, networked rural development based on assets. Secondly, institutional capacity. What is it about these places that allows them to have a vision and to work together towards these ends? I'll suggest that these are knowledge resources, network resources, and the ability to mobilize collectively. I think you'll already have gathered from what I've said that I also see a very important ingredient being an enabling state. In all of these examples, the state has had an important role in working with and enabling these things to happen. And finally, social innovation, the idea of a quadruple helix. And I'll explain each of these now. And we can then think in our workshops.